Case 20-4133, Lee Briggs versus University of Cincinnati. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Neff for the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
The district court committed two errors in this case. First, it erred when it held as a matter of law that UC established its high burden of proof on its affirmative defense to show that neither sex nor race factored into its decision to pay a Caucasian female substantially more than Mr. Briggs, an African-American male. And it erred when it granted summary judgment to UC based on the honest belief doctrine, ignoring that UC failed to provide a reasoned and considered belief, dismissing Mr. Briggs' retaliation claim. I'd like to start with the race and sex discrimination claims. By accepting UC's proffered justifications for the pay differential, merely because UC enumerated them without requiring the university to prove that at the time it hired Cassandra Whitwer, a Caucasian female, and paid her over 15% more than Mr. Briggs, an African-American male, that it considered factors not based on race and sex. As such, the district court erred. The university's shifting justifications relating to the pay differential and the disputed facts about its affirmative defense warrant sending this case to a jury. The director of compensation, Ken Sidham's unrefuted testimony is that in 2015, when the university hired Cassandra Whitwer as a compensation analyst at a salary over 15% more than Mr. Briggs, that both he and the CHRO at the time supported raising Mr. Briggs' salary in order to be commensurate with Ms. Whitwer's. At a minimum, Mr. Stidham's admission warrants submitting this case to a jury because it is at odds with UC's assertions in this case. While UC's litany of proffered reasons could explain the pay differential, it does not in fact explain the pay differential. It has not provided sufficient uncontested evidence to prove that its asserted justifications do in fact explain the pay differential such that a reasonable jury could not find to the contrary. As such,
I've struggled with the two standards that are involved here, because I know there were some statements in the briefing that, effectively it's the same standard for the Equal Pay Act and Title VII, but your argument today and in looking at the law, it seems to me that there is a distinction in the Equal Pay Act. At the second step, doesn't the defendant have to prove as an affirmative defense, whatever proof is required for an affirmative defense, to make the burden shift back to the plaintiff? So isn't that a somewhat different standard than Title VII, where at the second step, the defendant needs only to articulate, to say. So keep us, as you're making your argument, please let us know whether you're in the Equal Pay Act and whether you think a different result might come in the Title VII case because of the difference in the two standards.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely. The Equal Pay Act standard does have a different standard, and that is what we are applying, and we believe where the district court erred. Instead of requiring UC to prove its affirmative defense, it essentially took the lesser burden of persuasion, burden of production, excuse me, standard in the Title VII context. We do not believe that that should be the appropriate standard in this case. As this court has held in Bunton versus Breathitt County Board of Education, where a plaintiff defeats the defendant's motion for summary judgment as a matter of law on the Equal Pay Act claim by raising genuine issues as to defendant's purported justifications for the pay disparity, he also defeats the motion on the parallel Title VII claim. And that's what Mr. Briggs has done here. The university offered several justifications for the pay disparity. The initial justification offered by Mr. Stidham, the compensation analyst, the compensation director who hired Ms. Whitwer, was that Ms. Whitwer's prior salary warranted the justification. However, he admitted that Mr. Briggs' compensation needed raised. Mr. Stidham's, however, testimony does not have to be believed because he also said that the budgeted compensation for the position was $53,000. He based that on the prior salaries of two Caucasian women, not on Mr. Briggs' salary, whose salary at the time was a little over $44,000. So instead of looking at Mr. Briggs' compensation to set the budgeted compensation for the department, for the position, excuse me, Mr. Stidham looked at what the two Caucasian women had earned previously, which was significantly higher than Mr. Briggs. At a minimum, this establishes a question of fact for the jury to consider whether Mr. Briggs' sex or race factored into, or Ms. Whitwer's sex or race factored into her being paid higher than Mr. Briggs, who is the only African-American male in the HR department at UC at that time. Additionally, UC has shifted its justifications regarding what factors it relied on. First, Mr. Stidham offered two factors. At summary judgment, UC provided six factors. And then on appeal, now it's asserting five factors, two of which were never raised below and are thus waived. Four of the factors UC is presenting to this court were never identified by Mr. Stidham, the decision maker, as justifying the pay differential. There are also issues of fact surrounding the testimony between Mr. Stidham and the CHRO at the time Mr. Briggs complained of race and gender discrimination in 2017, Tammy Grineau, about why Mr. Briggs' equity request was denied in 2015. That divergent testimony warranted submitting this case to a jury. Ms. Grineau claimed that Mr. Briggs' 2015 equity request was not supported by either her or Mr. Stidham because of Mr. Briggs' alleged poor performance. However, Mr. Stidham directly contradicted that in his deposition testimony, and he contradicted that on November 9th, 2017, when he communicated in an email to Ms. Grineau the justifications for the pay differential, where he claimed he supported raising Mr. Briggs' pay. We ask that this court reverse the district court on this issue and remand Mr. Briggs' sex and race discrimination claims for trial. I'd like to also touch on the retaliation claim, if that's okay with your honors. The district court erred when it held that UC met its burden on the honest belief doctrine sufficient to defeat Mr. Briggs' prima facie case of retaliation, despite UC not contesting Mr. Briggs' prima facie case. By relying on Ms. Grineau's bald assertion that Mr. Briggs was not qualified on November 7th, 2017 for a senior compensation analyst position as she had authorized it to be posted, the district court erred. The only facts UC purports to rely on is Mr. Briggs for this justification that he did not qualify for the senior compensation analyst position was disputed communications on November 14th, the day after Ms. Grineau's complaint of action. What Ms. Grineau did is two business days after Mr. Briggs complained of race and sex discrimination, including that he needed to apply for a senior compensation analyst position, when he noticed that many of his Caucasian female coworkers were not forced to do so. Ms. Grineau pulled the posting and added a bachelor's degree requirement, which she knew at that time Mr. Briggs had not yet achieved. UC cannot use the 2020 hindsight of Mr. Briggs' disputed comments on November 14th, again, which occurred after the complained of action, or his disputed deposition testimony regarding his qualifications to buttress its own belief that Mr. Briggs was not qualified for the position as posted. By blindly assuming that Ms. Grineau's description of her reasons were honest, the district court acted in contrast to this court's precedent set forth in Wright versus Murray Guard, Clay versus UPS, and Smith versus Chrysler Corp. We ask that this court remand Mr. Briggs' retaliation claims for trial.
Let me ask you one question. Are there disputes of fact generated by the differing testimony of Stidham and Grineau?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Ms.
Please.
Particularly on the equity request, there's a dispute regarding what occurred. Ms. Grineau denied that Mr. Briggs had even made an equity request in 2015. Additionally, the two of them dispute about Mr. Briggs' qualifications. I see that I am out of time. Can I continue to answer?
Finish?
Thank you,
yes,
Your Honor. Additionally, Mr. Stidham testified that Mr. Briggs qualified for the compensation analyst position, which also had a 7-year of experience requirement, whereas Ms. Grineau claimed that he did not. Further, when she was able to look through Mr. Briggs' resume, she did admit that several of his qualifications while working at UC and prior to working at UC did amount to relevant compensation evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hendershot?
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Moore, Judge Clay, Judge Strange, may it please the court. I'd like to begin with Judge Strange's original question about the standards here. And I think that the district court, both sides are on the same page here. There's a slight difference between Title VII and the Equal Pay Act in terms of the standards. So I'll endeavor in my discussions and my remarks here to use examples from the Equal Pay Act, because even though some of this court's cases, for example, the footnote in the Vejar opinion suggests that in most cases, they end up in the same place, there is a difference. There's a slightly higher burden under the Equal Pay Act on defendants because what is not an affirmative defense under Title VII is an affirmative defense under the Equal Pay Act. But I think we're all on the same page there. The district court cited the same cases that we did, that Briggs did, things like Timmer and Schleicher and so forth. And this court's leading cases about the Equal Pay Act. Now, I'd like to talk about the divergent testimony that Mr. Briggs' counsel mentioned quite a bit during her remarks. Now, there may be some difference as to exactly what was said in some of the initial meetings when Ms. Grineau was new to the job a couple of weeks in, and right away, Mr. Stidham, who's the common supervisor to the two main actors here, Briggs and his coworker, Ms. Whitwer. But any differences about exactly what was said in the meeting aren't relevant here to the core question. The core question here is there, however many ways you want to count it, was there a performance difference between Whitwer and Briggs? There was, both at the initial hiring, where the testimony from Mr. Stidham was that Ms. Whitwer demanded a $53,000 salary to come over from a different part of the university. She gave an impressive interview. She came with outstanding recommendations. Those were differences from the outset. And so even though it was at the high end of the salary to bring her over there, it was the leverage she had from her outstanding reputation to come over to the part of the university where she worked with Mr. Briggs. From there,
help me understand that, because I recognize that there are reasons that you would pay more and that there is a range that would be within a job title, but this was a pay equity claim. And that has to do with not only the internal payments that are made by your client, but also what the market bears and what Mr. Briggs was saying. And he had some support from Mr. Stidham, was that you are beyond the parameters established by the marketplace outside the university, and you are at paying me outside lower than the parameters of the span of money that is normally paid to people who do exactly the work that I do. So explain to me why you have the ability to say, we're hiring somebody at this higher rate because this person is really qualified. We're hiring her into the very same job that you do, and we will not consider pay equity, which is the rule within the university, in making that determination.
Well, Your Honor, several points to make about that. There is, of course, a wide difference between looking at a market number and what the university might do for reasons having nothing to do with federal law, whether it's incentivizing or recruiting and so forth, and what federal law requires, which is that it simply be without animus based on sex. So any other reason can justify. The glaring reason here is a dramatic performance difference from the beginning, and I'll touch a bit on how it grew over time. So the fact that Stidham was saying at times, perhaps it would make sense to pay Mr. Briggs more, does not mean that federal law required that he be paid more. And that makes it like cases, for example, and here I'm going to use Equal Pay Act cases consistent with my beginning remarks, cases like Ambrose and Ballmer. In both of those cases, there was somebody at the defendant saying, your pay is at the low end. If we had a budget, we would like to pay you more. But the comparators in both those cases had, just like Ms. Whitwer did here, they had leverage because of either their experience, their reputation, their education, various factors there, just like we have going on here, that said, that showed they were going to be able to command more money, either to get them into that company or to retain them. And that's
when you say that a particular employee has leverage, does that mean that there's a pool of employees you're looking at for comparative purposes, and of the available applicants, there was something outstanding or more qualified about the person who was demanding the additional amount? As I understand here, at least it wasn't presented in the arguments or the briefing, that there was a number of applicants of which the person hired was the best, and that she had, in that regard, there's some leverage or whatever. That just is not, that wasn't presented in the record. Argued to us, is was something left out in that regard that you know about or would like to add?
Sure, I guess I would like to add this. If I understand the question correctly, it was there a pool from which Ms. Witt was selected? And I don't think there was testimony about any other competing applicants, but the leverage she had was she was at a different.
She was just personally identified or recruited because some higher up decided that in particular she would be the one that they wanted to bring into the position. Isn't that what happened there?
Yes, sir. I think that accurately portrays what the record says about Ms. Whitworth's hire. She had the leverage to not join this part of the university because she was already at a different part of the university and she was not going to move over absent the salary that she was paid. So it was not a matter of her being selected from a pool, but she had an outstanding reputation at the university. And this is something, and I haven't yet gotten to the performance differences that played out after Ms. Whitworth's hire, but this shows that paying that higher salary was a great decision by the HR department, because within 90 days of Ms. Whitworth moving over to that department, she earned a cash spot bonus. It's not something that happens very often in public employment. She earned that by so impressing everybody she worked with. When it came time for the annual performance review, and there's just the two folks here that Stidham is evaluating, you have Ms. Whitwer earning the highest possible score, and you have Briggs earning the lowest score ever for an HR employee in the memory of anybody that testified in this case. There's also anecdotal evidence about the dramatic differences between the performance of these two folks, whether it was in the performance review, the clients at the university complimenting Whitwer and saying, at all costs, retain this person to the university. She is such an asset. On the other hand,
bonuses, you know, bonuses can be pretty discretionary, particularly someone who's been there such a short time that, as Ms. Wentworth, didn't have much of a track record. Set aside the bonus that may well have been terribly discretionary or at least partially subjective. What sort of measurable metrics regarding performance as between Briggs and Wentworth might have been utilized to measure performance? Give us some objective metrics that were used in terms of productivity or quality of work.
Well, sure. Though the performance reviews themselves, you have two rounds of those, and that's gathering information from the same person that's overseeing both of these individuals. You have
this. Well, that's just opinion. Again, that's discretionary. It's important being thought of well by supervisory or management is terribly important. But were there any sort of objective metrics that we gained just in terms of productivity or performance or otherwise that we could look at?
Well, the performance reviews do mention just productivity generally. There is the, and this is, I believe, anecdotal, but there is the time that Mr. Briggs was reprimanded by Stidham, the common supervisor, for leaving work with a lot of projects undone and not even telling his supervisor, having, and we cite these in the brief, having a large backlog of the data entry work that he did. So those are, now they're anecdotal because they're particular instances, but this is the kind of work that I don't think you have the same kind of metrics like you might have on a factory line or something like that. But these are, remember, the performance review and the spot bonus are contemporaneous things that happened long before these concerns were raised in 2017, alleging discrimination based on being a man or of his race. And so you have
relative to the second series of evaluations, how long was it before Mr. Briggs received a wage increase? How long after he had sought an equity pay increase? Didn't he file two requests for equity pay increase that were both not acted upon?
Eventually, there was one acted on near the very end of the timeline here. So there, if we're just talking about increases generally, there were bonuses paid all across HR, end-of-year bonuses, different from the spot bonus that I mentioned earlier. And then there were kind of across-the-board raises that went to almost all the people in HR. And then at the very end of this, there was an equity adjustment near the very end, right before Mr. Briggs took another job. So have I addressed the timeline that Your Honor is asking about?
I guess what I'm really struggling with is this equity pay increase that request that was ignored. Let's assume that the person who came in really did qualify and you had to pay that amount of money in order to get them. What you have here is someone who's saying, the two white women before me for this very same job made this money. The new white woman who comes in today makes more than those. I want you to look at the parameters within UC, and I want you to look at the parameters that you already collect for the marketplace itself. And under those circumstances, I'm doing the same work that those three white women did, and I am being paid considerably less. Help me understand why that doesn't state a claim that it could be related to the color of his skin rather than the few credentials that Ms. Whitfer has.
Sure, let me start, Your Honor, with the three different women, the way that you set that up. There were two predecessors, right, in some of these similar positions.
Who made in the 50s, right? Made in the $50,000 range, correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. The reason I hesitate slightly on that is that Briggs has never pointed to either of them as being someone he was similarly situated, whether in the briefing here, the EOC complaint, even the university investigation. So we really, frankly, I don't think we know enough about their performance, their longevity, anything about what their salaries came from. But now let's focus on Whitworth. And I think one part of your question, Judge Strange, was, well, maybe she had these qualifications to begin with, but what about the equity request? Take a look. I'd encourage you to look at page 156 of Mr. Briggs' deposition. That's 156 in the consecutive pagination of the record here. He says, it is true that Grunow, this was at the time the head of all of HR, told me that that equity request in 2015 was turned down for reasons of performance. But performance is something that right off the bat, you have the spot bonus and the different evaluations, and throughout the entire time, you have a dramatic difference in performance. The other two that were no longer in these positions, the other two women, Judge Strange, that you referenced, I frankly think we don't have enough information about them because not the way that Briggs has chosen to litigate this case. He said—
But under the Equal Pay Act, the fact that it's asserted that he was turned down for performance reasons, if he comes back with information as he has that suggests that there were other reasons, then isn't there a fact question that such that you would, and under the Equal Pay Act, you having the burden of proof of the affirmative defense, this would warrant letting the case go forward as opposed to summary judgment in your favor?
Judge Moore, I think that's right. The pretext is where Briggs at least seems to point to evidence that undermines what a reasonable jury we think can only conclude here from the dramatic performance difference. And I'm not sure what that information is that he has pointed to. He certainly believes that there was discrimination here, but you have this documented performance difference from day one through the day that he leaves the university. And the one person that he says would support his claim, that's Ken Stidham, is somebody when he was deposed, he called Ken Stidham not an honest person. He has this zigzag relationship. Stidham is honest or not, depending on the time of this litigation and the time of the internal investigation. So I'm not sure what there is that Briggs has pointed to that he would say supports the idea of pretext. You have every metric you can look at here, whether it's the anecdotes we've talked about or the contemporaneous information, shows a very wide gulf in performance. If I might very briefly touch on the retaliation point, two things here that justified, that shows there's not retaliation here. There's one, Briggs said in his own deposition of being walked through the 7-year requirement that he didn't have the qualifications. And number two, Ms. Grunow said he was never in consideration because of his documented performance inadequacies that we've been over. I see that I've run out of time, Your Honors. We ask that you affirm the judgment of the lower court here. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Neff?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. I want to touch on this performance issue. All of the evidence that UC purports to present here on Mr. Briggs' performance is considered anecdotal and irrelevant. Mr. Stidham did not say that he paid Ms. Whitwer more because of Mr. Briggs' performance. Mr. Stidham also denied that Mr. Briggs' equity request in 2015 was denied because of Mr. Briggs' performance. In fact, as Judge Strange pointed out, they never did anything with his equity request. They just let it sit there. Mr. Stidham didn't tell Mr. Briggs that it was denied due to performance. It wasn't until over a year later when Mr. Briggs complained about Ms. Whitwer receiving a higher bonus than him that Ms. Grunow claimed that there was a denial about the performance. However, Ms. Grunow also denied that there was ever an equity request. So there's a lot of disputes of fact with respect to that. In terms of how the performance relates to the retaliation, Mr. Briggs was never given the opportunity to apply for the senior compensation analyst position because Ms. Grunow, 2 business days after he made his complaint, altered the position such that she knew there was no way he could qualify for it. In terms of his deposition testimony, he does say in his deposition that he was qualified for the position as it was approved on November 7th. He goes through all of his prior qualifications. Ms. Grunow also testified in her deposition when actually looking at his resume that many of the qualifications that he had did relate to his role as compensation and was relevant for purposes of the senior compensation analyst position. Ms. Grunow's testimony also that Ms. Whitwer, even though she did not have 3 years of compensation experience at the time that the senior compensation analyst position was posted, miraculously would have qualified for the position, while at the same time claiming that Mr. Briggs did not, she needed three because she had a bachelor's degree, leads this to a disputed fact where a jury could find that Ms. Grinnell was motivated by Mr. Briggs' complaint in altering that senior compensation analyst position. It also supports the pretext evidence on the retaliation claim, supports the pretext evidence, on the Equal Pay Act claims, all the plaintiff needs to do is just produce some evidence of pretext. And that's what we have done here. In terms of the questions about the internal and the external market, I just want to point out the internal market was based at UC was based on the compensation of the two prior Caucasian women who had held the position. And in his affidavit, Mr. Stidham testified that when he initially hired Mr. Briggs in 2013, he did so at a salary $7,000 less than Eve Underhill, who was a Caucasian female coworker. At that time, he claimed in his affidavit that the only reason he did not increase Mr. Briggs' salary was due to, quote, budgetary concerns. So there's no evidence that Eve Underhill qualified for a higher level position. And additionally, the budgeted compensation that even though he couldn't pay Mr. Briggs more due to budget, he was able, allegedly, to authorize $53,000, the budgeted position for the compensation analyst position, according to Mr. Stidham, that Ms. Whitwer ultimately received was $53,000, over 15% more than Mr. Briggs. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your argument, and the case will be submitted, and you may disconnect from the video. Thank you.
Thank you.